Thanks for coming to this. I understand they shut down the floor down there, and everybody thinks it's go drinking time. So thanks for showing. Appreciate that. My name is David Starr, and here is your opportunity to play Snipe the Speaker on Twitter. There you go. And we're just going to talk today about different ways that are evolving in the space of executable specification. This is an area that I'm very passionate about myself, and there is a lot of activity in the industry around this topic right now. Been on this project? Yeah, for sure. Still are. Sorry to hear that, sir. Well, this is not uncommon because it's very typical, in fact, to let that intermediate date that we had predicted, where we were going to throw all of this code over the wall to QA, and that slides in the middle of the project. So we push that date out. And so a very natural thing that my quality assurance manager used to ask me is, so that means that the ship date's moving, right? That poor guy. He never got the answer he wanted because I couldn't get it for him. Well, we've learned, actually. We are better than that right now, aren't we? We don't do this anymore. Now we do this. So we do it the same way, just more often, right? This is what iterative incremental development looks like for most teams. I'm curious, actually, if people in here are doing this. Are you experiencing this? Because I have had a lot of conversations this week with folks wherein they ask, what do testers do in Scrum, for example? What do testers do during an iterative incremental development cycle? How can the testers test anything before they have any software to test? And I would say that implicit in that question, as some of you have actually heard me say already this week, is the assumption that the job of testers is to verify existing functionality that developers have already created. We're going to look at some ways that maybe testers might spend their time differently. So when you ask me, or ask these big $5 consultants, as my dad used to call people like me, big $5 consultants. You ask big $5 consultants what it is that a really good development cycle looks like, say in Scrum, where you've got a cross-functional self-organizing team with everything on it and everybody's doing a little bit of everything all at once, they tell you it looks like that. Right? You're doing to devist. You're doing a little test, a little dev, and you're sprinkling all over the place. And it actually works if you can get some magic fairy dust to help you there. Anybody actually pulling this off? Little dev, little test, little dev, little test? Well, that's good. Really? Okay, couple. Maybe what you're doing is what we're about to look at, and that's how it works for you. Most people find this very difficult to achieve. This idea that I can set a tester and a developer together, say at a pairing table, and that something good comes out of that. That's very hard for a lot of organizations. So we're going to look at a model where we're trying to get from creating a requirement or stating a need for some software all the way to creating some functional software, delivering that thing, and demonstrating that we've met the requirement all through compiled code. So what I've done is I've implemented a compiler for Word, and I think you'll really enjoy it. That's not true. Okay. The way we do this is for each requirement we have, we develop acceptance criteria. Now, it turns out there are some different ways of stating acceptance criteria out there in the world that are new. You've probably seen user stories and user story scenarios already. We'll see some of those today. Those turn out to be things that create a really good requirement. So we take a given requirement and all of its associated acceptance criteria, and then we work on each one of those criteria. Now, what's a criteria? That's the answer to the question every time a development team says to the customer, the product owner, whomever, yeah, but what about this? So when a developer or development team says, you know, I understand what you want, but what about this situation? The answer to that is an acceptance criteria scenario. And what do we do with that? Well, hopefully, I have a person on my team with a specialty in quality assurance in some way that they're able to create a failing integration test or a failing test. I can take that answer, that yeah, but thing. What happens when I put a space in the text box and then I click search? And I can take that and I can compile it into a failing test, and I hand that off to some devs, and then maybe they go away, and if we've got a good development team, they'll use TDD, and they'll go build out their feature, maybe from the top of that app all the way down, but that is a separate thing. I want to be real clear that the TDD stuff we've been talking about, many of us this week, is a little different than this. That first failing acceptance test is, in fact, an integration test, and all of them will be. Once we've implemented that system, hopefully with test-driven development, because that helps our design so much, we'll make that integration test pass. We do that over and over and over, and it turns out that now is what it means to develop software. Just kind of a funky idea. I don't think that when we talk about specifications and requirements, we are thoughtful about it. What I mean by that is my software doesn't actually have to do anything unless it's going to physically fail a test. That's not a requirement when you write it down in Word. It's a desirement, something you want it to do. But we have no programmatic way to enforce that. We said we were going to look at user stories. I have no doubt that people in this room have already seen this structure. However, one of the things that we forget very frequently is the scenario component of it. This given when then thing is one way to express that. User stories have been around for quite a while now. In fact, people seem to think that's the only way to create requirements anymore, I've noticed. And I never really got why they mattered. As a developer, they never really spoke to me. As a I want so that, so what? I never really cared. People who are product owners and work at the business level of an organization typically have use for that expression more than technical folks. Technical folks, though, often are able to take that given when then piece of this and do something interesting with it, and that's what we're going to play with. So as a very simple example, we can say, look at this test. This is a unit test, right, using MS test. So here's a test method. The total in the shopping cart should be, total items in the shopping cart should be one when one product is added. Makes sense. And so we new that guy up, then we add a product to the cart, and then finally we assert that there's one item in the cart. About the simplest possible test in the world, and it turns out you can overlay this vernacular on top of that code pretty simply, pretty easily. So let's go play with that a little bit. Here, I have, I should run our app for us, huh? Let me get this app to at least spool up here. This is nothing but a ridiculously boring forms over data little app here. Here we go. It's for a code camp in Boise, Idaho, where I happen to live. So this is our Boise Code Camp registration site, right? So I'll add a few people to this. I don't know. We're making it up here. Now when I go into each one of these, I have the ability to change the names, and further, I have the ability to delete them. So what this shows me is some reads and some writes into that database, which is a lot of what we do out there in the world. A lot of data reads, a lot of data writes, display, and all that good stuff. So that's why I like to focus on this as a very simple problem domain to talk about how we might specify the behavior of this system and then prove it through executable specification. So the place I like to start is when we look at an existing unit test. Now, we started trying a few years ago to build our unit tests in such a way that they read nicely. Let's take a look at this one. When I run it, should pass, we can actually read this as a sentence. When inserting a new attendee, the attendee is in the database, right? You have to sort of chain all that together, those two clauses, for it to make sense. Let me spool up a little magnifier here so we can see better. So the idea here is pretty simple. What if we named our tests differently so that we could read them? This is where I started, and I had great success with it for a while. The next place we could go with that looks a little funky. Again, this is an integration test. We just happen to be using a unit testing framework to set it off, right? So we got this big setup, and it does all this crazy stuff to the database, clears it out. And then here's the real system under test, if you will, the presenter of a model view presenter pattern that's sitting underneath our app. You may have noticed, well, I guess, here we go. You may notice now that this is an ASPX application. Okay, so this is an old web forms application. I chose to do this because I don't want you to think that this is somehow special and unique to some sort of newfangled technology that maybe you've seen for the first time here this week. This is stuff that we can do to Windows forms if you want. Okay, all it requires is a decent architecture that'll support this sort of thing. So we new up this presenter, and then we add a person to, or rather an attendee, by calling the add attendee method, and then we do an assertion about that. It's a horrible looking test method. Horrible looking. It's got so many things going on. So we started playing around a few years ago. The community did, actually. Started playing around with ways to do this differently. One of the things that we came up with pretty quickly, let's see here if I can get my keyboard right. All right. So one of the things we came up pretty quickly with was the silly little technique of creating a base class for all of my test classes. Here's one example. And it sets in place a vocabulary for the developer. You might think that we're trying to set in place a vocabulary for the user, right, or for the customer. That's what we said in the first place, is that we have some sort of tester, and that tester is helping us out by telling us what the tests need to do. And that could very well be their contribution before we start writing code. But they don't typically think in terms of a range act assert. You'll notice that that's sort of the vernacular of this test. So when the setup fires, we're going to... The base method will call this virtual arrange, and then the act on the child class, whatever it is. And then the child class will turn around and assert. So that's what we're doing here. So I'll go ahead and set this guy up, and I will do you all the favor of not making you watch me type this out. So what we have here is an arrange, right, that's doing the same stuff we were doing before, and then an act, and note that these are the overrides in our child class. But this one got much simpler, and now our assertions become much simpler too. So now we've at least teased the elements of our test apart into these units of arrange, act, assert, and to a developer, to me, that makes sense. That's how I like to think about things. As a developer, arrange, act, assert makes sense, so does it matter that when I run it? Does it matter that when I run this test? Let's see. I'm going to run it in this runner. So I'm kind of glad Peter had to go home this morning, Mr. Provost, because then he's not seeing that I'm using the ReSharper test runner right now. Let's run that guy. There we go. Okay, so the reason, actually, that I'm having to run this in the ReSharper runner is something I want to show you. It's kind of interesting. I'm using this weird syntax of my class name when inserting a new attendee, and then my method name, the attendee, is in the database. Well, I'm depending on all of that to like wire up and make sense. And what that means is that I've just created an inheritance model that maps to my tool. Is that a good idea? I don't know, but I can tell you that when I come run that same test in the new Visual Studio 2012 runner, it looks like that. And now it doesn't read like anything anymore. All right, well, that was a nice try. And we did this for a little while. And then some frameworks began to emerge. The most notable one of these at this point is Gherkin. And I was stunned to learn two things. Number one, this is a tablet computer with a touch screen. So I spent an extra couple of hundred bucks for this thing because it's going to be sweet, right? And so I'm going to run Windows 8 on it. It's going to be awesome. The only thing I've done with that touchscreen so far is draw that pickle right there. That's it. That's a $200 pickle. Turns out that a gherkin, I didn't even know it was a vegetable. Gherkin's a vegetable, but also a domain-specific language. It's a DSL that is specifically readable by both, it meant to be, I should say it that way. It's meant to be readable by both humans and computers. And the job of the Gherkin language is to specify the behavior of software. And it uses that structure that we talked about just a moment ago where we said things like given, when, then. Because the Arrange Act Assert really makes sense to developers, but maybe not to my mom. In fact, we used to have something called the Connie test where I worked. And Connie was a very nice lady. She was an older lady. She was in her 60s, but she was our receptionist at the office. Didn't know a lot about software development, go figure. And one of our tests for whether or not we'd written good specifications was whether or not Connie could read it and then explain to me what the software would do. I mean, she knew our product, but she didn't know how we were going to make it. And that turned out to be the entire intent of that little exercise. And Gherkin worked pretty well for that. The other interesting part of it is that when you're done, you can generate a report from those tests such that maybe Connie can actually see those things be red or green in a test report, and she'll know the progress the development team is making toward completing a given feature. This straight up works, and it did work. Here is the Gherkin structure, the formal Gherkin structure. It's nothing you haven't seen a few moments ago, but this turns out to be an actual feature file. So Gherkin has this sort of structured syntax. There are some pieces to this. For example, let me get my cursor over. For example, you actually have to give a name to your feature. The reason for that is so that I can walk around in the hallway and say to Connie, hey, you know that feature, add new user? And she'll say yes. And what I don't have to say is, you know that feature in order to blah, 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 right? So it gives me a handle. And the same for scenarios. You know that no text scenario? It's just a nicety. Well, Gherkin actually requires that of us when we build our specification tree. Talk more about specification trees in just a bit. So this started to work. Now we used this on another project with a woman named Michelle. Michelle worked for a veterinary supply company, I believe in somewhere in Kansas. She didn't know anything about software development either, nor should she. She was the customer. That's why she hires us types of folks, right? And we were implementing an e-commerce system, by the way. And over the course of the next, you know, the few months that we worked together, we started with her telling me what she wanted the thing to do. And then I would sort of translate that for the team. I was playing the role here of sort of a business analyst. And she would say to me, you know, I want a screen that does this. And I'd listen, and then I would respond to her, you know, here's what I heard you say, Michelle. I heard you say that given this condition, given this state, when this happens, then this should be the result. And she would say, yeah, just like that. It was a natural language. It just flowed. She didn't realize I was speaking pickle to her. And about a week, 2 weeks into this, she started saying it back to me. I had never told her any of this stuff the way I'm explaining it to you. She just started talking back to me like this. She would say, you know, I guess, Dave, given this, when that happens, then that should be the result. And I said, you now have access to edit the backlog. You are a winner. That was awesome. What she didn't realize she was doing is defining steps to our test plan. And Gherkin actually identifies these as test steps. Since this is, in effect, a model from which we can compile, or I'm sorry, And to back that up a little bit, since this is a model from which we can generate code and then compile that code, there we go. It turns out that each one of these steps is representable as a method. So now I can write code in there. And you kind of saw the beginnings of that a few minutes ago. And another cool thing about this is that it comes, if you go out to the Gherkin project, you'll see that it comes in about 47 different languages. This one happens to be Norwegian. So that's cool. All right, let's check out Gherkin. And the way we're going to do that is with a tool called SpecFlow. How many people in here are using SpecFlow? Okay, thank you. That's a pretty good number. That's actually significant to me because that means it's catching on at least a little bit. This isn't crazy anymore, maybe. Or maybe it's you're the only ones at Tech Ed. I don't know. Maybe we're the crazy ones. The idea behind this is that I can go into Visual Studio, and I've got a test project here. And I can, let's see, create a requirement. I'm going to create a requirement here. Before I do that, I'll tell you that I have installed SpecFlow, a product, on my machine. This is not just a library that I include. It's also a product that I install on my box. It's open source. It's free. So that's cool. No problem there. I'm going to show you some stuff that's not free in a little bit. So we're going to add a new item to our project. And in this case, we're going to add a SpecFlow feature file. Now, Gherkin, remember we were talking about user stories earlier? I love the fact that Gherkin doesn't really call anything a user story. It calls it a feature. Okay? We're creating features in our software. I dig that. So we're going to create a feature, and in this case, let's call it, and I'll stick with the thing that we were testing, just because we're playing with tools, I don't want to vary the domain for us. So we're going to have a requirement here to add a new user. Actually, it's an attendee, right? Because it's our code camp. There we go. And when my feature file opens, you can see I get a little editor inside Visual Studio. That's cool. I don't want to focus too much on the tool, so I'm going to pretend that I've had all these conversations with my development staff. So let's think about this. Before I go too far down this road, how many people in here use some sort of iterative incremental development process where you do a little planning, you do a little coding, then you deliver some software? Cool. That's enough to say it this way. When you go into planning, think about this. You're sitting around maybe doing estimation. Maybe because you're in this session, you're an agilista and you're doing planning poker. Just maybe. Well, if that's what you're doing, think about when you're going through that process, the person who has brought this paragraph into the conversation is trying to justify the feature. They're trying to explain the feature. Remember, they're answering questions about it. But what about this? But what happens when? And every time there's an answer to that, we're going to record it as one of these. Do you think that maybe, just maybe, we could have Visual Studio open inside that meeting? In that planning meeting, could you have this thing right here open? Note that it is a versioned item in my project. I can actually check this into version control. So I have seen teams do this, and it works quite well. Now, I just saved that file, and when I did, a little code behind file got generated. This just happens to be the way SpecFlow as a tool works. That's not the way all of these tools work. There are, in fact, scads of versions of tools out there right now that try and solve the same problem SpecFlow is trying to solve. SpecFlow does it really well, and it's quite popular because it does it really well. But just realize that this is a very dynamic and evolving space. There are a lot of alternatives. Okay, so what's going on back here? What just happened to SpecFlow, if we go down and look at it, actually created a unit test. And here is our test class attribute on that class file. Here's a test initialize or a class initialize, right? So it's running through the workflow of those of a test class. And then for each one of those steps, remember we said Gherkin defines those steps. Each one of those steps is mapped to a test method. But there's actually no implementation to any of this. There's two things I want you to notice about this. One, there's no implementation yet to any of these tests. Two, this is a string. It's just, again, happens to be SpecFlow's implementation. Guess what's true about string matching and regular expressions and all that? It can be a little brittle. I've had people struggle a little bit with this, wherein you've got a feature file that might get out of sync with a code file. Well, it's not too big a problem. So there we go. I just ran our tests, ran these in the new test runner. Let me run them over here in the ReSharper runner, because they do look a little bit different because I can see the class name. Any day. Or maybe I should just start from the top. There we go. Anybody ever notice that one way to get the ReSharper test runner to run is to hold Alt-R-U-N, run, and it runs? That's awesome. Wouldn't you like to be that guy? All right. So there we go. We see this, and now we look at this particular step, and it tells us this is what the code is supposed to look like for the implementation of that particular step. So we can actually just copy and paste it right out of the test runner. It's a handy little thing for us. Great. The way we'll do that is by coming over here and adding a new class. And I'll call this class Step Definitions. Should probably make that guy public. And there we go. I'll put that code snippet in there that I copied out of the test runner, because this is what it's telling me you forgot to do, right? You haven't done this yet. So I'm going to run it. Oh. I've actually been using the new test runner in RC, and every time you build, I have that build on demand feature, and every time I build, it runs my test, and I'm not used to running tests anymore because they just always run. Okay, so down here, this guy has changed state. I should have. Let's see. Let's pull up the. Let's stick on the ReSharper runner. Let's just do that. Good grief. Come on. There we are. Now we can see it better. Okay. So I'm going to run this guy again. Uh-oh, no matching. Let me do a build, and then we'll try once again. No matching step definition for the given. This isn't a good sign for the demos. Hang on. Tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to take this, and I'm just going to put in the full implementation of the SpecFlow step definitions file. So we'll skip ahead just a little bit and pretend that we wrote all this code. Okay, and that lets me hopefully get a passing test here. Looks like it's thinking harder this time. Good, there we are. Now if we drill into this guy, you can see it took me into that code behind file, but that's not where the work's happening. The work's happening over here. And each one of these is a step that I've put some code into, right? So for example, if I want to make a particular given, got too many test runners open. If I want to make a particular given clause matter, I have to put some code in it. That's all. So as we said, it maps to these steps. So what do you think about that? I can now check this in. I can make these part of my build. What I find a lot of organizations enjoy or teams, I should say, is that I'll have one project, say this project, that is specifically for people who used to be called testers to go out and create feature files. And they do this during all of our planning, during our planning for the next sprint or whatever the case may be. This is also what you may have heard as being described as the process of backlog grooming. Some people call it other things, but the simple fact is if you show up to that sprint planning meeting, you're surprised by what you find, something went wrong. Okay, so you should have probably had some discussions preparing these requirements. Preparing those requirements means creating these scenarios. So I do that inside Visual Studio thus far. How does that work for you guys? Who thinks this is something they could use? Not everyone. I'll admit that this is kind of funky. I mean, not all of our testers are going to be using Visual Studio, right? Well, there are some other ways around this. I want to talk real briefly, too, about sort of steps. Let's back some of these out. Well, I don't actually need to write code to make this point. When you start passing these scenarios, when you start working on the tests as a development team, you take them one at a time. That sounds simple, but it's not. It is simple, but it has a great impact on your workflow. Because now what it means to be done with a particular sprint, perhaps the sprint, maybe you're using Scrum, whatever, is that you are getting that requirement to show as passing and met, and then that one, and then that one, and then that one. This limits the work in progress on our execution by accident. And it's a pretty cool thing. Because I'm a dev, I'm sitting here, I want to make the happy path pass. So it turns out that the happy path actually consists of all these steps. Right? Given I'm on the attendee screen and I wrote that method, and I've entered a valid first name, then I write that method. I mean, it's just 1, 2, 3. It's not rocket surgery. It's pretty cool. So I plumb this in to my build, and I run this as part of my build automation no less than every day, at least every day. And, you know, just about every unit test framework out there lets me gen a report, which I can do with this because it turns out SpecFlow is just building on top of MS Test. Remember that? It's just MS Test. Or, by the way, in unit. Oops. Hate the little cap lock key. In unit. If I do this, hit build. Oh, blech. It will regen all of those code behind files with in-unit test harnesses instead of MS Test. It makes sense that it actually built or died on the build because I don't have a reference to in-unit. Or XUnit. XUnit, in-unit, or MS Test. You can get SpecFlow to gen your tests as any of those frameworks, whatever you're using already, run them on your server. Make sense? Who's using XUnit? Anybody in here using XUnit? What are you guys using? Just shout it out. MS Test. What else? InUnit. Anything else? Really? MSpec. MSpec I love. MSpec is da bomb. I'm not going to show MSpec up here because it doesn't run yet in the new Visual Studio Runner. However, the guy that owns the version or that owns the source project, I was talking with him last week, and he's working on it. He's going to make it run. So by the time we have a drop, MSpec will run. I'm going to show something even weirder than MSpec, though. You'll love it. All right, let's go back to MS Test. I will say this for Microsoft too. I don't have to feel totally ashamed of the fact that I might use MS Test once in a while anymore. It runs a lot faster than it used to. It's particularly in the next version that's coming out, the benchmarking of performance has gone through the roof. They have totally changed the internals. And so MS Test has gotten some significant improvements going into the next version. So that's a good thing. Alrighty, make sure that all of our tests still run and that we're good to go before I move on. So in my mind, that's cool. But you know, it seems to me like there's a piece missing. And to me, it's this. Let's pretend for a minute that we're using Team Foundation Server. So how do we get our specifications, or our requirements rather? Desirements, remember? If they're expressed in Word, they're desirements. If they're expressed in Team Foundation Server work items, they're desirements, because I can't compile that stuff, right? In my mind, the ideal world would be I go open up Team Foundation Server. I'm someone who wants the software. And I put in a request for some software to do something, maybe following this DSL. And instead of having that go into a database as some XML and plain text, it gens a code file for me. Wouldn't that be sweet? The guys that wrote SpecFlow thought so too. And I will tell you that I fundamentally changed a little bit of this talk as early as Monday of this week, because on Sunday of this week, wow, that's ominous. Something bad's going to happen now. On Sunday of this week, the makers of SpecFlow dropped the latest version of this tool. This is called SpecLog. SpecLog is a tool that knows how to manage a backlog, where that backlog is a big pile of feature files. Dig it? So what that means, let's just try and open one. We'll open what they call a repository. Let's see. I don't want to have that take forever. There we go. So here's a repository. They sent me two of them. I was in my hotel room and I was so happy because the internet was good enough that I could Skype with the developer of this thing who's in Austria, and he could send me this stuff on Monday. So here we go. Oh, all right, great. Already open. I should have checked. There we go. There's a pile. Of requirements, of features, desirements, whatever you want to call them. And it turns out that each of these is actually backed by a feature file. And if I zoom in, they change the rendering of these things such that you can begin to see this is a backlog. And this backlog is represented as something called a story map. Has anybody heard of story maps? It's a way to build and segment a backlog of requirements and show that this requirement has a technical dependency on this one, for example, and all sorts of coolness comes out of feature or story maps. This is a story map, and I can see that here is a main primary feature. As a shopper, you can read it there. As a shopper, let's get in there. I want to collect books I find interesting for reading. So this is a big pile of not real features that the guys at the company have created. Tech Talk is the name of the company. It's actually a consulting firm, not primarily a product firm. They built this stuff so that they could use it with their clients. That said, SpecLog costs a little money. So it's not a great deal of money, but it does. Okay, so as a shopper, I want to collect some books I find interesting. If you are comfortable with the term epic, maybe that's what that is. I don't know. Then you go down a little bit deeper. As a shopper, I want to collect books in my shopping list so that I can order several books at once. Now I'll click on the details of this particular requirement. Oh, and look, here are all the scenarios. So here are the scenarios that we were discussing in our planning meetings. I don't want this to be a product demo. That's not the intent. But I will tell you that a picture of the thing that I want my software development team to create, plus this structure of the behavior that I want the software to have, is perfect for most applications that are written as line of business applications out there in the world. It just works. I have implemented multiple projects doing this. This is real world stuff and it works. It's pretty slick. Now, I can now go up here and say, and there are other things you can do with this. I'm not going to go too deeply into the product, but I can link a Gherkin file. What they're saying is, show me the feature file you want me to inject this requirement into. Well, that's cool. Now, if I had Team Foundation Server 2010 installed, which I don't, I thought about doing it, but it, quite frankly, was a little risky for the demo gods to do all that, because I've got 11 on here, too. This talks to Team Foundation Server 2010. This will actually gen code file or feature files into your version control repository. This will map directly into Team Foundation Server version control so that I have this as an editor. If I'm the person creating the requirements, I don't have to work inside Visual Studio. It's pretty slick. Okay, enough of that. We just compiled the whole conversation between those who want the software and those who are implementing it. Nice. So you may have noticed on the first screen or so that I work with scrum.org. One of the things that I do two things there that are germane to this conversation. One is that I pay attention to the technology and how it impacts the way Scrum should evolve and how Scrum impacts technology, because teams that use Scrum happen to create systems that look different than systems that are created in other mechanisms. That's just Conway's law at work, right? The communication of the communication patterns and structures of the organization that creates a system will be reflected in the design of that system. That's Conway's law. So recently, The other thing I do there is we have this document called the Scrum Guides, the Rules of Scrum. We recently changed, 6 months ago, changed the definition of a sprint backlog. Specifically because I had copious, beers, with Mr. Ken Schwaber sitting around arguing about what I'm showing you right now. This, Ken, is a new way of creating a backlog. I don't have to decompose to tasks anymore. I don't have to walk into a sprint planning room and here's an index card, here are all the little sticky notes of all the things we're going to make. If I have a pile of tests that I can compile and show them failing, why can't the definition of a sprint backlog be make those tests pass? And so we redefined what a sprint backlog is. Now a sprint backlog is the following. It is the subset of the product backlog that has been selected for a sprint, plus a plan for delivering those product backlog items. That's it. One characteristic, a defining characteristic of that backlog is that I need to be able to sum remaining work at least once a day. Well, this is what it looks like when teams start using executable specifications as their sprint backlog. In the beginning, you can kind of think about what's going on. I just walked out of the sprint planning meeting right there. Well, in the sprint planning meeting, remember, maybe we've groomed the product backlog before we even get in there. So we're going to walk out of there with a few failing tests, at least a few. And so we get back into the team room or we get to work and we've got just, let's say, 10, I don't know, some number of failing tests. And the developers start working. They start writing the implementations of those tests. But what are the people who used to be waiting for the developers to be done doing now? The people who are best at breaking software are really good at writing these features. So they are going to define all the boundary conditions and all that stuff, and that is the meat of what goes on here for the rest of the sprint. Testers now are creating these failing tests all throughout the sprint, and developers are trying to catch them, not the other way around. It's fundamentally different, and it changes the dynamic on the team. It changes the entire workflow. And this is the answer to what do testers do when they're waiting for software. They shouldn't be waiting for software. They should be telling the developers what the software needs to do. It's a different way of looking at the world. And it turns out, too, that business analysts and quality assurance people share these skills and talents that make them really, really good at doing this. And those people are members of our team. They are not some other department over there. If they are another department, this isn't going to work. The other interesting thing that happens is you reach a point where we've kind of thought of all of the scenarios, or at least most of them, throughout the sprint. So let's say it's a 2-week sprint. Well, by about, I don't know, Tuesday of week 2, we've defined everything we want to come out at the end of this sprint in terms of feature files, maybe through that backlog management tool or whatever the mechanism is. And now I get to, as a team, as a maybe a testing specialist on that team, turn my attention away from specifying how the system should behave in terms of functionality to checking it about and doing some validation through things like exploratory testing, performance analysis. If you're not doing perf testing every sprint, you're going to be doomed to repeat the development or the Visual Studio 10 development cycle. Don't do it. You've got to actually do perf testing every single sprint. Those sorts of quality assurance mechanisms now, there's room for them. What do you think? You guys just asleep? Just tired? Long day? Some people are all jacked, I can see it. They're like, yes, when I get home, tell my boss about this. That's cool. All right, so because I'm who I am, I'm now going to make some gross generalizations because it's fun. It turns out that these systems that we build have some repeating patterns in them. No kidding. You guys knew all that. One of the things we need to do to be able to wire ourselves into these applications with tests like these is we have to decide, first of all, where do we want to tap in? And usually that's accomplished through a model view separation pattern of some kind, be it model view view model for XAML-based development, MVP, model view presenter, which is what we've been doing here. This isn't a discussion about the patterns themselves, but realize that you have to do something at that level to separate your model and views and business logic so that if you're using MVC, MVP, and BVM, you're going to have a much easier job tapping into this thing with these executable specs. Now, you can actually test against the view. If you came to the train wreck that was my previous talk this week, you saw that we actually tested directly against the view with a couple of tools right out of unit tests. And that can be done, but it's fairly brittle. Even the best tools in that space are somewhat brittle. We usually don't have to do much testing here. Now, there may be some model binding behavior, things like that, that we implement ourselves, particularly if you're using the MVC framework, that needs testing. But those are going to be unit tests. So I'm not going to tap in at this model level. Probably I'm going to tap in here. Right? So when I make a reference from my specifications to my system under test, this is the place. It's the bottom of the UI that most people choose to go in at. Again, you can go in on top of the skin at the view. And there are tools like Watton available to do that for the web, Watton for the web. Okay, but we've got some other things that we're going to be testing, and we developers are the ones that came up with this whole 1-2-3 thing in the first place, and it turns out that the other things we have to build also benefit from this nomenclature. This given when then thing works for us mentally too. So one of the people here in the crowd uses MSpec, machine specification, is a unit testing framework in effect that reads given when, or I'm sorry, that reads context because of, and then some assertion, right? So it'll say, given this context, because of this thing that I do the system under test, then this. Has a goofy syntax, it's different, but it's essentially doing that arrange, act, assert thing that we talked about before. I'm gonna show you another one here in a minute that's even goofier. And that's how we test the things that we find down here, because we still have unit tests that we have to create as we develop out our system. These integration tests and these functional acceptance tests that we're creating on the top end aren't the whole story, right? We still have loosely coupled design that we're going to get by going through unit tests at this level. Hopefully you're not having to do much testing here. You should be wrapping that, whatever that is. So if you are doing tests that test against this layer directly, I would question if you could maybe change that. There are code first ways of doing data access now, particularly with Entity Framework. Entity Framework 5 has even more features for this. And even if you're stuck back on like EF3, you can wrap something around EF to isolate it. You should be seeing things like repositories and units of work, things like that down here, so that I can isolate that data access. Most of my unit testing will be happening inside this domain layer where I've got my own custom entities, commands, queries, repos, those sorts of things that all need to be tested. Anybody here ever actually done any unit testing with databases directly against data? It's pretty slick. Yeah, that's cool. There are way more, there are way more people in here that are doing that or have done it than I would have thought. Four. It's like a unicorn, man. Nobody's ever actually seen this done in the wild. So it turns out that Visual Studio 2010 had some tools in it that let us do kind of that, that let us do things like unit testing and refactoring against databases. And, you know, there are other tools out there that let us do it too. So people do it. Well, I want to show what that can look like a little bit lower down in our application. Over here, I've got, first of all, these were our acceptance tests. I'm just going to unload these so we don't have to look at them. Those projects now can go away. Here I've got some developer tests. And in this case, this test is going to simply test a command. So I've got a command that deletes an attendee. Now I'm using a unit testing framework here called SubSpec. SubSpec actually is built on top of XUnit. I mentioned XUnit a moment ago. By the way, the gentleman who created InUnit, well, let's go one back from that, who did the .NET implementation of this InUnit, because we kind of stole that from the Java guys. That's the real truth. His name is Jim Newkirk. Jim Newkirk then went to Microsoft, and they asked him to create MS Test, and he barfed, and instead created XUnit as an open source project, along with another guy at Microsoft named Brad Wilson out of the Patterns and Practices group, or at least he was that time. Now he's over in the ASP.NET teams. And this thing, XUnit, is just the way unit testing should be. If you're not using it, do. Try it. Just try it. It's so much easier. You don't have all these attribute decorations and everything. Instead of setup, you've just got, a constructor. It's pretty slick. So this particular tool, SubSpec, is built on top of XUnit. And what we've done here is I just went ahead and set up all the little dependencies that my test is going to need so we wouldn't have to spend time doing goofy stuff there. Here's a requirement that I've typed out as a set of three strings. Make a new delete attendee command. Now, this is very much a specification at a developer's level of understanding. This test that I'm about to write is not for Michelle. It's not for Connie. It's not for people who are going to be looking at this in a specification report. It's for the next developer who opens my code. And this is indicative of the kind of goofy syntactic sugar we'll find out there. So I'm going to go to this string, and the way subspec implements itself is as extensions to strings. So we're going to provide our context right here inside this extension. And it takes an action, so we'll just go ahead and do it anonymously like so. Here we go. So what is the context of creating this thing? Well, we need to new up that fake data context. I'm not going to get too far into what that is, but it's basically my substitution for EF, which I'm going to push down into this command. Okay, so I need one of those. I'm also going to need an attendee. I guess it's not going to work. We'll see. So my attendee, I'm going to get one from something I call something we can call a mother object over here. I'm going to create an attendee with an ID. All that guy's doing, that's just a little helper class that's inside my unit test project, and it's similar to me saying, create me a fake one, create me a stub, whatever the case may be. I'm just creating one off of a static method off this little mother class. See? Silly little test stuff. Okay, so now I've got one. I've got an attendee. Now I want to new up that command. So this is my system under test, right? And I have to pass it a data context, so I'll give it that fake one that I created. That fake one, by the way, if we look at it, implements iData context. So this is just my custom home-rolled implementation of a data context, but I'm only going to use it in my test class. So what I'm able to do is add functionality to it that only tests will care about. So for example, if my containing command calls the commit method that would normally be called on a data context, what I'm going to do is I'm going to basically set this flag. This is a custom property that committed one so that I can check it. This is called a spy. This is a type of test double called a spy. Okay, so now that guy's set up, there's my initial context. I want to invoke my system under test. Again, it's just 1, 2, 3. The language of subspec happens to be context do. What are we going to do? We're going to execute the command. Okay, that's the next step. And then we do an assertion. And we can make assertions about this. So there's an extension method here that looks like this. You guys hear that, by the way? Who's going to Universal Studios tonight? Seriously, you guys are doing it? Good for you. Anybody want a wristband? I brought mine. Seriously, if somebody needs a wristband, if you're the first one to ask me for it, it's yours. Okay. So what are we going to do here in this assertion? Well, what we can assert here is that our fake data context, actually, I need to provide a real assertion, true. Ah! Don't hit that many keys in front of that many people. There we go. True. So we want it to be true that on our fake data context we have called commit. That is that little fake, spy property that I hung off there. And so we looked at a couple of things here. One is a little bit of isolation technique, right? We saw the use of mothers creating up those fake things. We saw a fake data context by implementing my system under test interface. That's all sort of tangential to what I think is the interesting piece of this, which is actually the subspec syntax that it's using to basically do the 1, 2, 3 thing. Let's go ahead and run this. And I'll use Peter's runner for this one. Let's go control RA. Do a build. Oh, good. At least I built. Test Explorer. Test the delete command. Why aren't you running? There we go. We're running. I think my machine's all bogged down with PowerPoint or something. Oh, of course. What's it going to tell me? What came out false? I remember why, because this happened in my hotel room right before I came here. And there's the answer. All right, great, I'm home free. I forgot that I actually had to add the attendee to my fake little in-memory database. Okay, that's the only change in code I made, actually. There we go, we'll run it again, and our test passes. Cool. Now, when we look, though, at the output of the test, let's see, let's make it fail. Looks more interesting when we fail. Cert. Let's see. I guess assert false, that'll make it fail. Good grief. Okay. Run that guy again. Where's the output? So this test runner isn't giving me what it usually gives me. Well, doggone it. Bottom line is, I want to be able to see those strings read as a requirement. They actually can read as a requirement. I don't know why the test runner is not liking me and playing well right now. But it sort of runs together. The sentence that we're trying to assert about this system under test, make a delete command, use it to delete an attendee, and the command commits the data change. Now, that's a different way of doing that 1-2-3 thing. I think subspec is significant because of this. It doesn't constrain me to a DSL to express my requirements, because check this out. The DSL is actually this bit. It's the methods. And these are things developers care about. Business people don't care about that piece. That piece where we've been trying to tell them all this time, oh, you got to learn how to do context, do, assert, or arrange, act, assert, or given, when, then. Even given, when, then. Why should they have to think that way? This is the first one of these frameworks I've seen that lets the expression of the requirement be whatever in the world you want it to be, as long as it comes in a 1-2-3 sequence. Make sense? So maybe we'll see a way to gen requirements like this without having to adhere to a particular grammar. I don't know. I just like this one. It is really coming down out there, man. All right. What do you guys think so far? Anything? That's really cool. I heard that. That makes me feel good. I'm happy inside now. All right. You know how we always have pyramids in software development to show stuff? Here's one. And it says what you can probably already figure out, that when I'm looking at a pile of code that's being tested this way, this is sort of how it ends up looking in terms of test automation. I will have some tests on the top of the UI usually. I'll do that personally, me. And the reason I do that often is because I want to be able to do some type of deployment tests so that when this thing is deployed into a new stack, I want to run those UI-based tests against that particular endpoint and see that UI responding. That's how I use those tests mostly. And often I'll do it to verify that a specific new feature has been deployed so we can know that that's the version. I'll actually have a UI test that reads out of some HTML on some page and checks the version number, something like that. Okay, and then we've got all these feature definitions. We saw that with SpecFlow, we've got all those .feature files as a way to do that. There are plenty of others. And that's where we have the conversation with Michelle and Connie and others who want the software. I turn that into the set of documentation. of the feature set. It's pretty cool, and it actually works. One time, anybody in here use Prism from Microsoft Patterns and Practices? Couple? It's a composite application framework for WPF and Silverlight. Silverlight, oh, okay. Don't go there. And in the first version of it, a friend of mine there at Microsoft who had worked on it, his name's Glenn, and I called him and I said, hey man, how's this thing work? I pulled it down, how's it work? He said, go read the tests. And I thought, of course, that's how us agile hippies are supposed to do this. So I went over there and I looked at his tests. It doesn't really work. As much as I wished it did, to go read the unit tests of a particular project isn't really the documentation of that system. Not really. I mean, it kind of is, I guess, as a mental exercise. But you know what? The way Glenn wrote his tests was what was going on in Glenn's head. And as I read the names of all of those tests, they don't actually make a lot of sense to me. As much as he tried to express himself to me in those test names, eh. But those feature files, because they adhere to that strict grammar, actually worked very, very well. Prism didn't have that. I'm just saying that in other projects, I've seen that actually turn into documentation that helps me understand how the software works. And then finally, we do have a great big pile of unit tests that we use to build the software as we build it. The way I like to think about those unit tests, because they are working against the domain layers, is we're building a jig for the domain, just a little ahead of the implementation. Sort of like a boat builder builds a jig before you lay a boat, you know, you build a boat on the jig and then you take the boat off and you launch it. You take your software off the test jig and you launch it. Same thing. So we want as little of those as possible at the top. I like to have at least one or so features per requirement in my backlog. And finally, I like to see at least one unit test per class or module. It's a general rule of thumb. Don't take that as a gospel or anything. It comes out to be what it comes out to be. Whatever feels right for you is probably fine. Now there's this. I found this great feature in PowerPoint where you can remove the background. It makes everything look all professional and stuff. I guess I shouldn't be proud of my PowerPoint prowess. Okay. We're pretty much afraid to change our software. Actually, that's the fear of change that we have in a lot of cases. I know that I've been in companies where you'll actually have a conversation with somebody and say, go add this feature. And they'll say, what are you, crazy? I'm not opening up that code. If I touch that code, who knows what's going to happen, right? And it turns out that that's a big part of why we do some of the things we do in terms of test automation, because if we poke the code like that, maybe by adding a new feature, we don't know that a little bubble pops out on the other side, right? Because we just changed functionality in that system. We didn't know it. And so what we try and do is wrap some sort of automation framework around our code. This is called penning of functionality. If you've read Michael Feather's book about working effectively with legacy code. It's a great read. He calls this a pen type test. These feature definition files, these are pen tests. That means that they pen functionality in place. And if that functionality changes, we'll know it because a test will fail. That's exactly what these types of tests do. And so when we poke it and we pump and we do, if we do, for some change in functionality, we get a little red blinky light. And a little red blinky light draws our attention to it so that we can then change without fear, and that's what a lot of this is about. And there we're at the end of this. So we went over the way that I really, really like to compile everybody's desirements. I just refuse. I've become that guy. I refuse to call them requirements until they exist in code. Because nothing requires them to be true other than, you know, you want it. My code can require code to do stuff. My boss can only ask me to do something, and I can always convince them that I did it. All right. The tools language, my boss. You guys know who that is now, so I shouldn't have said that. Tools, languages, and techniques. Yeah, this stuff is super fragmented out there in the open source community. This is evolving. There is no right way to do this. And the frameworks in particular are going through tumultuous change right now. Quite literally, some of these tools that I've showed you this week have dropped in the last couple of weeks. Those were just the latest ones that I thought were interesting that I wanted you to see. So it's a fun place to look out there right now. And if you think about it, take the next logical step. And I'm not saying we're going to be there for 5 or 10 years even. But if I can specify the intended behavior of the system in terms of a model called a domain-specific language, why can't I then gen the verification code of that system? Well, we saw that we can do that. And if I can do that, why can't I also gen the stubs of the system itself? We're not quite there yet. But isn't that an interesting thing to think about? Okay, you will not scale if you don't start automating your functional regression. Period. The end. Unless you want to scale with humans. And scaling with humans hurts. Okay, so my ask for all of you is to go home and compile a requirement. And if you do, send me a copy of it, and maybe we'll talk about it and blog about it. So thank you all very much. I appreciate it.